Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight, and we have a full house in here. I want to welcome my guest, Terry Woolman, a great guitar player, also a producer, arranger, and we're going to get into all the different things that he's doing, and I'm very jealous of his Valley Arts guitar.
Well, that's why I brought it, Jeff.
Yes, I'm just eyeing that thing. It's like, yes, I'm not worthy. No, anyway.
You actually are.
Also, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Also in studio, a very lovely singer, Melanie Taylor. Thank you for showing up and coming by and hanging with us.
Thanks for having me.
We might just put a guitar in your hands. I'm just teasing.
You don't want that.
And then, of course, my very dear friend, Lori Reamer, that introduced me to you. And thank you very much for helping me actually putting this show together. So we got a good group here tonight. And what I want to do first is just start out with talk about your background, because you have a very interesting background in a man of many talents and wearing many hats.
I do. And, you know, to nobody's bigger surprise than my own. But I consider myself a pop musician with a jazz background. Mm-hmm. And I've always written songs. Mm-hmm. And I grew up playing a lot of different instruments, and my main focus was always guitar. But, you know, I studied drums when I was a kid and piano and played clarinet in seventh grade. Not very well. That turned out not to be one of my gifts. However, I was just always interested in a lot of different aspects of music, and I wanted to learn how to notate music so that I could write my own music. And then I started taking classes, and I actually started taking theory classes at Miami-Dade Junior College in Miami, where I was born and raised. Mm-hmm. And that led me to going to Berkeley and getting a degree in arranging, and actually being the first arranging major. Yeah, which was the arranging program was designed around essentially what I told them what I wanted to learn while I was there, which didn't exist.
That's great.
So they made me do many, many things more than what they expected I could fulfill, and I surprised them and did it because I was there paying for my own college and felt that I was the one responsible for getting the kind of education that I felt would prepare me for working as a touring guitarist and studio musician and also arranger. I always wanted to be the guy that when you flip the album over, my name was on the back, and that you would see arranged by, produced by, guitar by, you know, Terry Woolman. What I never expected was that I was going to be the guy that was on the front of the cover and becoming an artist, but that just, you know, that came about by, in a very honest and sort of organic way. When I moved here in 1981, the first tour that I ended up getting was with playing guitar with Billy Preston, which was a thrill. And I went to Europe and toured with him, and then came back and essentially couldn't get arrested, you know. And I thought, well, here we go. You know, my career is now begun. I'm going to be touring and playing on records. And it didn't go that way because mm-hmm. that's not the way it always goes. So I started looking for ways to create opportunities for me to play in clubs. And then I found out that, well, I would need to put a band together and then have music to play. So I just started writing more instrumental music because I really pretty much had focused on writing vocal tunes. And so I started writing for a band. I put a band together, and kind of there was no looking back. You know, I've mm-hmm. done that mm-hmm. as well as being a sideman and being a producer and arranger. They've all worked forward simultaneously.
Well, I want to interject one thing.
Yes.
Which you just said about, and I want to bring out, the fact that you learned, interesting, clarinet is the same range as guitar. Mm. And also, too, learning those other instruments, perfect. I mean, in terms of an arranger, but I think also in terms of any guitar player, that you're aware that you listen to the other instruments.
Absolutely.
And that affects how you play. You play by reacting to what everybody else is playing, as opposed to a lot of new, younger guitarists, they just shred. They just go.
Right.
And you need to listen. So, you know, I mean, and a lot of people, like we had Troy on, he was talking about that too. Mm-hmm. The key is listening to the other players and how the whole interaction.
Troy Dexter is another good example because he is a multi-instrumentalist.
Right.
So he understands the broader picture of what his responsibility is. And I do as well. I approach it that way because actually, you know, guitar, first of all, is a percussion instrument. You just like piano, you mm-hmm. know, technically in the classical world. Mm-hmm. In the classical world, this wasn't even recognized as an instrument when I was in college, you know, in conservatories.
I remember those days.
Yeah. It wasn't in an orchestra, right?
Though. Right, yeah. I mean, Segovia was out there and Christopher Parkening and...
in front of orchestra.
Yeah, right. Right, they were, but not in the orchestra.
But electric guitar was, like, forbidden.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I love listening and interacting with the other rhythm instruments and with the vocal and just finding my place in mm-hmm. in the machinery of what makes a good pocket and groove.
Well, I'm going to play a clip right now. This song is actually getting a lot of attention. It's been very acclaimed. It's the number one most added on Billboard.
Yeah.
This is a clip from it called No Problem. And also, too, I really want to briefly mention, because Sam had told me about this, too. You sometimes co-host one of our sister shows next door at the video channel, Inside the Music.
I do, yeah.
So Terry's a veteran from here, so I didn't know that.
Yeah, this is like coming home.
Yeah, coming home.
And I also host my own radio show, Making It with Terry Wallman, from my studio.
Okay, and well. When's that on?
That's on live every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. It also is archived on the entertalkradio.com website, as well as on iTunes as a podcast.
Okay.
So if you go to iTunes and look under podcast, Making It with Terry Wallman, you will see the last year and a half of shows that I've been doing, and they've been pretty fascinating.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. All right, let me go ahead and play No Problem, and you'll get an idea again. In terms of the arrangement, the interaction of the different instruments, and then we'll go into what you did and who's playing on
Great.
This, because there's a good group on this one. Now, there's, as you can see, that's a pretty extensive clip, but there's a lot of things happening.
There's
in
a lot going on.
So I love that riff that you do.
Thank you.
That thing. And then, but you can hear when the sax is going on, and I was going to try to cut it, but it's like, I'll just play the whole thing because you're doing cool, you're just doing cool things.
Yeah. Right. Well, all
with the rhythm guitar, the clean guitar.
Yes.
Right.
And you can hear it just come in, and he's kind of, you know, he's just playing his counter rhythm, which you're talking about percussion.
Right.
It's that kind of. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about what you did on that.
Well, what I did was took a song that I'd written back when I was music directing for late night talk shows that I'd never recorded. And I actually brushed it off to play for my 60th birthday concert. And we had so much fun playing it live that everybody in the band said we should record that. So I gave it some thought on what to do to make it fun, you know, and fresh for me. One thing that we did was recorded live. So I went in the studio with Greg Manning on keyboards, Hussein Jiffrey on bass, John J.R. Robinson on drums, and myself. The four of us cut it live. I played the melody live with the band. And then did the rhythm guitar parts back in my studio when I had a chance just to kind of live with it. We added a couple of keyboard parts as well just to juice it up because I wasn't sure if I wanted to leave it. I actually thought about doing two versions, just the quartet and then releasing one that was built up as well. But as we built it up, I started to really just fall in love with what was happening very organically with the track. So I thought, all right, I'm going to add two electric rhythm parts for balance. So, you know, one left, one right. And then I brought in Mindy Hebert on sax, who's a dear friend, and because I wanted not a jazz sax player, but a rock sax player. And she actually toured with Aerosmith playing sax with Melanie singing the same year when Melanie was singing with Aerosmith. So I brought Mindy to my studio and recorded her there and then added my two rhythm parts. And I was just looking to keep it as an arranger and producer to keep it percolating and to keep it interesting, not to become predictable, because that to me is the strength of the arrangement. There's the repetition of the lick, the melody that I have doubled with sax, but I keep changing the harmonies. You know, I changed the chords or I build a stop time into the final out chorus. But I also kept growing the two rhythm guitar parts and just finding the holes. And it was a very stream of conscious performance for me with each of them, each of those parts. And then I would listen. I also used different guitars and changed the EQ settings. And so that they really lived in their own world, that they didn't compete with each other sonically.
Now, I want to get in a minute about the, because you sent me notes about the different guitars. We got to talk about that.
Yeah.
But also, it's interesting, the arrangement, because it works as like a, it can work as intimately as a, well, you could actually do it as a four piece.
Yeah.
But even just a five piece with the sax, but I can hear it with a full brass section. I can hear it.
Right.
And it goes either way.
Yeah.
You know, it works.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's talk
now
a little bit
ideas.
About what you just throwing that out, nudge nudge. But let's talk a little bit about what you are doing. Let's start with the rhythm guitars, which is that real glassy type of very cool sound with a little bit of chorusing or something.
No, it was in my hands. You know, it's just moving the strings a little bit.
Okay.
So it just a little bit of delay. A little bit of compression, but I didn't chorus because I didn't want it to get too thick. I wanted them to be a little bit more like the bones in the meat, which is a funny analogy because I don't eat meat, but it's
or
a picture
bones.
or bones, but that picture comes to mind. So I wanted everything. When I mix, it's like painting for me. I love mixing, and I want when the listener closes their eyes, whatever style of music, and we'll hear that in all of the things that you're going to play today, that you can you can picture each instrument and where they're sitting in the room, whether they're closer or further from the mic or to the left or to the right of you. I like to create these worlds with mixing. So the interesting thing is I use the exact same amplifier for all three of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
So the rock overdrive lead I actually used my Mesa Boogie Mark 525, which is a small head with a 12-inch open back cabinet. You know, standard miking, you know, just a couple of inches away from mm-hmm. the cone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use the overdrive in the amp for the lead. I'm a big fan of amp overdrive, you know, tube overdrive. I just think it's really...
Yeah, and it sounds great.
Yeah, it's wonderful. You know, all the pedals that we have are to simulate what happens when a tube breaks up. So whenever I can, I use that. But then I changed the EQs. You know, I was very conscientious of which pickup selectors to use, which pickup selections on each of the guitars. You know, whether I was using a neck bridge or, you know, bridge.
Well, which guitar did you use for the distortion lead?
That was my Valley Arts, the red maple Valley Arts
the
guitar.
Maple.
Yeah.
Okay.
With EMG pickups. So I just put it on the distortion full out, you know, on the humbucker because it had two single coils and a humbucker. I put it on the humbucker and just full out and dialed in the tone through the amp.
Okay.
That's how I got that sound.
Did you have to do a lot of EQ in the post, or you pretty much got the sound from the mic?
I got it pretty close. Yeah, so there wasn't a lot of EQ in post. A little bit, you know, I generally leave in a little bit more bottom so that I can carve some of that out to make room for bass and lower frequency instruments because I don't want everybody stepping on each other frequency-wise. So I do that with EQ. And then also with panning, you know, and reverbs as well, but mostly where I place it in the panning. You know, if it works dry, then it's going to work with reverb. So, no, there wasn't any really dramatic EQing of the three guitar parts, the two rhythms or the lead.
And
after,
all,
because
and
I
the
did,
rhythm ones are using the Mesa Boogie too, right?
Yeah, I'm using the Mesa
so
Boogie as well.
Everybody's using the, which guitars did you use for the, clean parts?
I used, this one. The Black Valley Arts Alder Strat that I've had both of my Valley Arts since the late 80s, early 90s. And then I used my Anderson Strat, which is about 15 years old, I believe. I actually wrote the year down.
Now, does that have just Anderson's standard pickups, or is that...
Yes.
This one has Seymour Duncan.
Yes, I endorse Seymour Duncan. So when I worked very closely with the people at... actually with Mike McGuire and some of the other amazing people that ran the Gibson Custom Shop back then, I'd let them know that I had a Seymour Duncan pickup and really wanted to use Duncan pickups. So we chose together. You know, they worked very closely with Seymour, and these are single stacks, or they're hot stacks is what they're called, the single coils, because I knew I wanted two single coils, and I have a JB humbucker. I wanted a humbucker for the leads, but I was working on a TV show, on a late night talk show, where we were on a stage, and back in the late 80s, early 90s, they had a lot of neon on TV. So we were getting a lot of the neon frequencies and the hum that was getting picked up by my single coil. So Seymour suggested the stacks.
So, but the stack is a humbucker, isn't it?
It's a humbucker, but it sounds like a single coil, and
so you get the top end.
Well, and I can have it either way because I've got switches. So instead of a five-way position, there are individual switches for each pickup. So I can have single coil or double coil of each of these pickups. And this would just be the single coil.
And that's the neck pickup, right?
This is a neck pickup. But here's with a combination. And here's with the humbucker aspect of it.
Yeah, it's a little fuller. But it's still got the...
Yeah, but if I put two
overtones.
So those are both of these essentially... They're two single coils stacked on top of each other, so they're wired, so there's a lot of versatility. This is kind of a one-stop guitar.
Yes.
So,
well, these guitars are legend. I mean,
they are.
I remember when I was in school, a lot of the session guys were getting these guitars, and they were just, you know, all the greats were using these.
They are remarkable. They still are. It's gotten better with age, but it was pretty amazing when it was still shiny and, you know, had that fresh leather smell. You know, when you drive it off the lot.
But all the things that you're talking about, especially like doing television and stuff, with the lights, noise was a big
problem. Oh, it was huge.
Problem.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being so upset that I had to buy a piece of gear called a Hush 2CX that was put in my rack, and it cost a couple $100, and all it did was make things quiet that should already be quiet.
Right.
It didn't make any noise or anything, but, you know, that's what we needed to do back then when we had our large refrigerator-sized racks of gears with lexicons and Eventides and all the things that we did. We had to add something to keep it quiet, especially with all the neon. So so I used a single coil function of these stack pickups. My other, the red Maple Valley Arts, which is a 7/8 model, it's a little bit smaller. It's a Larry Carlton model. They designed it for him. It came with EMGs, and I was really tormented because I was, and still am, Seymour Duncan aficionado and lover and endorsee. That guitar sounded so perfect with the EMGs that, you know, everybody said, just don't, you know.
Well, they're active, right? So they're
active.
Real quiet.
Yeah, it was extremely quiet, and they are active. I never had an active pickup in a guitar. So they gave me both at the time so that I had the option, and I had both on stage, and I would use each depending on what sounded best for the song. So that way I still felt loyal to a company that has been loyal to me. And I'm a big believer in artist endorsements, is that it's artist relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I was never that guy. I got asked to be in a Fender ad, you know, back in the 80s. You know, they needed somebody with long hair that looked like a guitar player that, you know, and
typecasting.
It was typecasting. Yeah.
No, he said looked like a guitar player. Was
right.
It a guitar
right.
player?
They actually, they did want a real guitar player as well, but they had a look in mind. But I said the only way that I could do that is you can't use my face. So they did. That's why I said look, because they just went for profile, a guitar player in the shadows playing, you know, a Fender amp. And so I did do it. But I just, you know, I always had a pet peeve about seeing friends, at, you know, guitar player, bass player, drummer magazine, you know, in three different pages with three different pickups or amps or strings or endorsements.
Yeah.
It just never was the way I wanted to do it.
No, I have to admit that's really, it's true. Yeah, you stand behind what you play.
I do. And that's why I've endorsed Mesa Boogie Amps since I bought my first one. So I've switched amps over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But now the Mark 25, the Mark 525 is my main amp.
And well, how long have you been using Boogies? What did you use before Boogies? Fenders?
I did use Fenders. I had a Yamaha when I was in college, the one that Robin Ford used. I forget what model that was. I wanted the Music Man, you know, with the two tens.
Mm-hmm.
And it weighed a ton, but it was really expensive. So I got the Yamaha amp because Robin played it in the Yellow Jackets and played it with Joni Mitchell and just had the most amazing sound.
Was that tube or was that solid state?
Solid state. So what I basically learned later, that wasn't the amp, that was Robin. Yeah. but once I started using tube amps, you know, I played the Roland Jazz Chorus, the JC-30, I think it was, or
JC-120.
The JC-120.
The 212, yeah.
The 212. I played one of those. I don't think I own one, but there was always one around, so I would play that because it had a rich sound. I liked it. But once, you know, I would play Fender Twins, and some I loved and some I didn't. And then I went on tour with Billy Preston in 1981 and came back. And with the money that I made on the Billy Preston tour, I went and bought my first Mesa Boogie Mark.
Well, what did you use for Preston?
Well, those were rentals because we were in Europe. Those were two twins.
Two twins.
Yeah,
okay.
They wanted me to play stereo. So I actually had to go to Westwood Music at the time and buy a stereo chorus pedal and an Ibanez Tube Screamer. Mm. Those were the two pedals that I brought with me. No volume pedals, no wah pedals, no pedal board. And I had a Les Paul custom. And so one guitar.
That's it?
No backup guitar. I know. I didn't know any better. And
and
also we were schlepping our our stuff, you know, all through Europe. You know, so there was no cartage. So you know, I had my garment bag and, you know, like, you know, it was back in the day.
Yeah.
And so we were, I had two Fender Twins in at every venue, and some of them were, they was hit and miss, you know, with those. But I really learned the beauty of a tube amp. So when I was already in love with Mesa Boogies. So I went and bought one and then developed a relationship with the company. And I was unofficially endorsing them and then endorsing them. And that same thing, they had always been very good to me with support, especially working on TV and on the road. If I ever needed a tube or a rental, if I was doing something in New York or at NBC, they would just have an amp there for me. So so I've just stayed steady with them. I mean, I'm a fan of the Vox AC30. I mean, I love a great tube amp, you know, but I've just stayed with Mesa Boogie. So my collection over the years has not been an amp collection. Mm. I've always had one or two different boogies. I have two 12 cabs and then single 12s, mm-hmm. so that I'm ready for full, you know, stadium, you know, tour level speakers.
Right.
Or for TV and clubs where you're generally going to be playing quieter.
Well, when you play live locally,
yeah.
What do you use? You use the 25 or do you use a bigger one?
I'm using the 25. I mean, I still have my Mark IV. So that's a single 12 combo.
Yeah.
So I use that.
That's 100 watts?
Yeah, it's 100. So that is loud. That'll peel the paint off the walls. But the truth is that the 25 watt, I've used it with Melissa Manchester. I've used it at Capitol Recording Studios. I've used it at local clubs when I'm playing. And I have all the volume that I need, because if I play too loud, then the engineer can't do his job. Mm-hmm. And that's part of my television training, you know, is learning how to burn at a whisper, you know, so that an engineer at NBC, if we're doing a late night talk show, is going to be able to get a great sound and it's still going to have the energy.
Well, I'm going to play a clip of, since you say you're talking about using this amp. You didn't give me in your notes what guitar you're using, but this is a very special clip because it features Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, yes.
And I'm just going to play a little bit of this, and you can hear him singing. You arranged this.
I arranged, and I'm also conducting while I'm playing.
Right. But you were mentioning in the notes that they took your amp, or at least your cabinet, and put it in the closet.
They put the whole deal in the closet and then gave me like a 100-foot cable. So we dialed in the sound. I knew more or less where I wanted it to sound. So we set it up, and that way it was isolated so we could all play live together,
mm-hmm.
and be in one room together. And then I trusted the engineer. Yeah. So
now, what guitar did you use?
I played my hollow body, my Gibson L7.
This is the L7.
That's the L7 that I also played with on the Joe sample track that we'll talk about later.
Okay, let me go ahead and play this. And it was for an HBO movie. If you're not in the obit,
eat breakfast. Yes.
So here, let me play this, and then you can tell us who was on this because there's some great players on this too. This is Younger Heart with Dick Van Dyke.
Fairy tales can come true, it can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart? For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Is Isn't that wonderful? Dick Van Dyke.
So sweet.
Classic.
Right.
And it was live. That it was all done.
Yeah.
There's no overdubs. That's it.
That was live. Yeah, and we did a couple takes. And
that L7 sounds great.
It does. So the engineer is Peter Kelsey, who I have worked with on, I believe, my last three solo records over the years. So
he's an Emmy-winning mixer.
Emmy and Grammy Award-winning engineer. So I trust Peter. I mean, Peter knows what I like to sound like, but I also like his point of view and perspective. So I didn't mind him going into the room. I gave him permission to go and make any kind of EQ changes.
So you had the amp and the cabinet in the hallway. You just didn't put the cabinet in the closet.
Okay. Yeah. They thought, because there's a little bit of a fan noise and they just didn't want to get that. You know, because we had the acoustic piano. I'll tell you the band. It is Bill Cantos on piano, Eric Marienthal on sax, Nathan East on bass, and John Robinson, once again, on drums, and myself on guitar. And we just played, and Dick sang, and it was so much fun. It was just for all of us. It was such a treat, and for Dick as well.
He really, you can tell it's a magic moment. He must have had a blast doing that.
We all did. I mean, and it was, and, you know, Melanie, you were there with us. Melanie styled us as well because,
because one of my other hats.
It's one of her many hats and skills. But, you know, because we were on camera, they actually.
You were being shot.
Well, yeah, just to make it even more challenging, they were filming us as well because they put us in the movie. If you go see this HBO movie.
It's available on demand.
What's the movie?
It's called If You're Not in the Obit, Eat Breakfast.
Oh. It's a documentary about people in their 90s and above living thriving,
active,
fabulous lives.
Fun lives. It's hosted by Carl Reiner. And it's just about.
It's a beautiful movie.
It's about happiness and joyfulness. So.
And Dick certainly personifies that. I
mean, yeah.
Are you
he's
kidding me?
He's still performing.
He was at Catalina last week.
And he's at Vitello's
that's
a lot,
right.
too.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. He's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's that. It's a great little, the band's just tight.
Yeah.
Just what you guys did in that arrangement. Kudos to that. I mean,
thank
it's
you.
A great little, it's tasty.
You know, I gave it a lot of thought. You know, how do I imply a big band arrangement, you know, which would be that style? Without using a full string section and or writing for a, you know, a horn section or just an actual big band, we wanted the intimacy. Also, it would have been just far too expensive and far too many moving parts to be recording live at Capitol and filming and getting all of this done in a day. Yeah, because I also, we cut two versions. We actually cut three. There's an instrumental version in a different key, you know, for the movie with featuring Eric Marienthal on sax. And then I also recorded a duet version with Dick and his wife, you know. So,
oh, very cool.
You know, so there was all of this going on. So it was quite a challenge to do the arrangement. I mean, the arrangement ultimately sounds simple and uncomplicated, but there are enough critical elements in it of people playing lines together at various points or counterpoint that basically create an arrangement that's memorable. And even playing with the time, you know, it swings. Ga-doon, doon,
yeah, but it moves around a little.
But then at the, but da, got, got, you know, even eighth notes. Like when I came up with that, I went, okay, that's the arrangement. There's the magic. Yeah, because
it breaks it up and it
makes it very clear that this is not just going to be people just playing a jazz standard.
It's also sweet, I have to say, because we you know Dick Van Dyke is a dancer. He dances through his whole life.
Sure.
He wakes up dancing in the movies, and he you know we love him and we know him that way, like Bert in Mary Poppins and stuff. So that little eighth note break, and it reminds me of dancing.
Yes.
You know, he sort of tiptoes around, and so when you see the film, when you see the documentary, he's dancing. They do a whole, the whole thing, he's dancing throughout it, and he and Arlene, his wife, are, you know, interacting and doing a little soft shoe, and it's really darling.
Well, the arrangement, it's light on the feet, so to speak.
Right.
It's a very lilting, and
and
I think it was brilliant what Bill is doing on the keyboard and Eric playing in around his voice.
Right.
And then you're in there, you're basically the timekeeper.
Yeah, with JR. Yeah,
and which is like the old style,
it
old
is.
Style
it's,
big band.
That's
He's the main rhythm instrument, and the drums are doing the brushes,
but
he's doing a couple little
know,
hits on the cymbal or whatever.
Right,
and it's an interesting because it's that old style.
Yeah, And I later on in the song, I gave myself a little feature. I wanted to feature everybody, and the director of the movie asked me to do that as well, to build that into the arrangement. So there's a little break that's just JR for four bars or two bars. There's a bass break for Nathan on the upright. And, you know, I get the big ending. Yeah, you know, and then the band, you know, comes in, you know.
Well, that's very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, speaking of strings, I want to go to this other clip. And this is with I think if I'm correct, you're using your Rick Turner baritone?
Yeah, this is a piece called Once One Moment. And Rick Turner is a guitar luthier for, I would imagine you've spoken about him on your show.
Alembic. He made Alembic. That's what he's most famous
That's right.
for. But he makes Rick Turner guitars.
Yeah,
now.
And, you know, he worked for Gibson. He designed the Gibson Chet Atkins nylon string that so many of us used back in the 80s. And but he's got Renaissance guitars and builds his own guitars. But he's been building for a long time and designing. And back in the early 80s, when I was doing this Billy Preston tour, and I met Rick because he was at Westwood Music in this little cubbyhole in the back fixing guitars for Joni Mitchell and David Crosby and, mm-hmm. you know, all these very cool people. And he knew I loved playing acoustic guitars as well as electric. So he said, I've got this guitar I want to show you. And it was this baritone guitar that you hear on the recording that I now am the owner of. Rick lent it to me. And he said, just play with this. And it's a baritone guitar. It's tuned down either a fourth or a fifth. So you can tune the low E string down to a B or a C. And he said, just go have some fun with it. And so I knew about baritone guitars, and I thought I was recording a record, my Say Yes record, and I said I want to write a piece for a baritone guitar, and I don't own one. He said, well, let me loan you my guitar. So he lent it to me, and I had it for about a month, and I actually wrote the piece on that guitar for that guitar. I didn't want to write until I really understood the nature of the instrument, you know, that how it resonated and just the range, where it was more like a French horn or an alto flute,
right?
You know, than, you know, a standard steel string guitar, nylon string guitar. So so I wrote the piece for that and recorded it on that. And, you know, when I was working the piece up, I was having all kinds of problems with finger squeak, you know, because there's...
Well, every guitarist, when you put
every
a new
guitar
set of strings.
Right.
Especially and then when, acoustic.
Exactly. And then when you make it a baritone guitar, I mean, basically the low B string, it's a piano string. You know, it's really thick.
Wow.
You know, it's just, or like a bass string, you know. So, you know, it wore through my calluses. I had to build up on it. But the other thing is, it made more of a squeak, you know. And so especially when you are just so exposed. You know, I wrote this piece for solo guitar and strings. And so I asked Rick, I called him up and I said, what do I do about the squeak? You know, how do I approach this? And he said, I don't know. You're the first person who's ever wanted to record baritone guitar solo. You know, everybody else puts it in a track. You know, because I said, what does Jackson Browne do? Or what does Joni do? And he goes, they don't. You're going to be the one to figure it out and tell all of us.
Wow.
And basically I had to learn how to, just like you learn how to control your breath, you know, at the end of a phrase, you know, because that's going to be picked up on the microphone that's
right.
making your guitar. I had to learn to just alter my fingering so that I got as minimal squeak as possible. So
yeah, you lift up and move.
That's
and
right,
Chris. But also too, what I learned in school from the classical guys is talcum powder.
Yeah,
that really helps.
Yeah,
you know.
Which nobody told me. And none of my classical teachers told me that when I was in school. So perhaps it hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah, well, no, not, it was interesting. Yeah, but I'm trying to think when I was in school, they were all doing that because that was a big thing.
Right.
It was a big deal about that.
But they were playing nylon, and there's less squeak on nylon typically than on steel string.
Yeah.
This is baritone steel string guitar.
Now, I'm going to just, this is just a clip from a bigger piece.
Yeah.
So I'm taking it in. It opens up with a string section, which is, did you do the arrangement?
Yeah, I wrote the string arrangement
and
conducted
stuff.
It. Thank you.
So I'm going to take it where the guitar is playing solo. Then the next section, he's playing and the strings are behind mm-hmm. him, so you get an idea of what's going on. But I had the sound of this guitar.
It's magnificent.
It's really it's beautiful. So here's
once one moment.
Once one moment. Tongue twister for me. Here we go.
Man, there's nothing like live strings in a studio.
Now, before we start...
So yeah, Lori.
Lori, try your mic.
Hello?
Try it now.
We don't hear me. We hear me in the back.
No, that's the one I had. That's the one I had on.
Welcome
yeah, it
back.
Wasn't on. It wasn't on. I don't think so.
No, but I now had the I'm mute here. Off, but now I got it. So right. Sorry about that.
Good. Now I could say how awesome that was.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
Yes. Now,
and you, it was for what was this?
That was for one of my records. I wrote it for my on my Say Yes record. By the way, everything we're playing tonight, including the Dick Van Dyke piece and this piece, are on iTunes, so you can find them.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, are you playing fingers or are you playing a pick?
All fingers, no pick.
That's fingers.
Yeah, it's from my classical training. And I, the other thing is, any time there was an open string, I would use that to pivot to the next position so that I would get less squeak. So when there was an opportunity, you know, I really had to change my technique to play this song. And then also not worry about the squeak at a certain point. That's part of the beauty of the instrument. You know, it's real. It's a real
yeah.
person playing.
Well, that is true. There's a certain point where it's... indicative, it's part of the guitar. It actually, it would sound weird if you took
that's
it out.
That's right.
Yeah. Why is there no squeak?
But it would have been quite distracting if I hadn't had a month with that guitar to really understand how to adapt my technique to that instrument.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting too. Some of the chords, you got to watch what you're doing because it's so, it's a, you know, it's a fourth lower.
Yes.
So some things, you know, it's like trying to play chords on a bass. It doesn't always work.
As well.
Especially tight voicing.
That's right. Hmm. And then to think about how the strings are going to complement and not muddy that up any further.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the strings after I recorded the piece. So I did that one differently. There's no way I would have been able to play that and conduct those strings. So I conducted with a baton at a
how big of
session.
A section was that?
That was, believe it or not, I think there was... 10 strings, but it sounds so much bigger.
Did you double it?
No, I couldn't because it was rubato. There were, I had, let me see, 2 cellos, 2 violas, and then, oh, and then 3 and 3.
3 and 3.
6.
Did
yeah.
You didn't do double stops? Because that's pretty full.
I wrote a couple double stops, but okay. I wanted to double it, but I knew that I couldn't. So I just had magnificent string players. With an amazing Peter Kelsey, once again, engineering. And it was just, you know, that was
just
that
to great. Just to mention to people out there that might not be familiar, double stop, they have the violins play 2 notes.
It would be like this for the visual aspect of it.
Yes.
You'd cover 2 strings.
So they'll play 2 and it gives it a fuller sound.
Yeah.
If you listen to, like, for example, Alan Parsons, the arranger, Andrew Powell, was noted for that because they didn't use big sections,
right.
but they sound huge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was one of those things.
So were the players a section? Did they play together or you handpicked each one?
Handpicked.
Okay.
Susie Katayama was the cellist and contracted for me and was so dear, you know, that she just said, I'm going to get you the best players in L.A.
Hmm. And, and that was live, right?
Live.
With the section. You played with the section?
No, I didn't play with the section. I recorded my guitar part separately on a different day. And then I conducted, because I actually had strings on 2 songs on
okay.
that record.
So you did the guitar first, and then you...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been above my pay grade to play that and conduct
grow
that.
Grow another couple of hands.
Yeah, I just it wouldn't have been possible because of the subtleties of the beats and the holds. And I wasn't, quite frankly, I wasn't even sure how well it would work, because I didn't record to a click track. So it had to just...
Breathe.
It had to breathe, and everybody just had their eyes on me and their hearts on me and with me, and it was just exquisite.
Yeah. No. I mean, a lot of stuff was done that way in the old days.
Right. Exactly.
There were no click tracks.
That's
it was
right.
all feel.
Right.
And
yeah.
the fact that you played the guitar helps because you knew where you were going.
Yeah, you knew
it.
Exactly where the spots were.
Yeah, I knew where the breaths were because mm-hmm. I was the one who had breathed them the first
yeah.
time and holding my breath as a chord is ringing.
Right.
So.
No, it's a beautiful sound. It's a really...
Thank you.
We're almost out of time. I want to play one more clip, and then we'll talk a little about where you're playing and
yes.
stuff. I want to play 11-11.
Okay.
And this one, you're using some interesting sounds. Let me play it first, and then you can explain what you did on it. This is 11-11. It just kind of warbles out. Now that kind of resonant type of it's not a chorusing sound. That's the boss, right?
It's a boss pedal. It is the where is it?
It's EX7.
It's a Boss EX7 expression pedal, and I believe they don't make them anymore. I have two of them. I have a backup, and it's basically looks like a volume wah pedal, but it's got about 8 or 10 different settings that you can manipulate, including a wah, and you can change the filters. But when I felt across, this particular ambient sound, I just went nuts because it was so, it was so rich, and the way the sound does warble and move around and swirl, but it still had a clarity to it and a richness to it that I just love. So I thought, I need to write a piece of music with this. And I thought it would be really interesting to counterpoint it. By the way, that was this Valley Arts guitar, the black one, through that pedal, pretty much directly into, just into the recording. I didn't need to go through a Boogie amplifier for that. But I wanted to juxtapose that against the nylon string Ramirez guitar, because that is just a pure classical instrument. And then I thought it'd be really lovely to have a third element. And so I brought in cellist Tina Guo, who is just an exquisite musician. And she said yes to doing that. And then I thought, okay, well, if Tina's going to play cello, maybe I can write a cello quartet intro, which I wasn't sure even if that existed. But I thought it'd be really fun to write a four-piece, a four-part.
Oh, the cello and that expression, that EX7,
yeah.
Just work.
Oh, it's just...
It just works.
Yeah, it was a really beautiful moment being in the studio with her and having her play.
No, it's just... And your string writing is killer.
Thank you.
Now, we're out of time.
Yes,
so I want to do real quick, go through your pedal board real quick, and then we need to talk about where you're playing.
Great. So I brought with me, and we'll take some pictures for everybody, but I brought my travel pedal board, which I put together for one of the jazz cruises that we did, where you're carrying your stuff through airports. So I have an exotic wah-wah pedal that I really love, and then the SP compressor by Exotic, and then comes the AC Plus distortion. It's a dual distortion unit through Exotic, so I can have one setting for rhythm crunch, one for lead, and then you can combine the two as well. There's an EP booster by Exotic, which is a clean boost, but it also makes it a little bit more dimensional. And then I've got the old Arian stereo chorus pedal that still has that tri-stereo chorus sound that is very rich. And then TC Electronic makes a flashback delay that I really love. It's programmable, and it does some very cool things. So that's my... I've got a bigger pedal board with other things in it, but this is the one that I use for traveling, and it's kind of pretty much... I bring a volume pedal as well, and it covers
the basic everything. Food groups, as
it
we
really
say.
Does. The basic food groups.
Yes. Now, real quick, we're out of time.
We are playing.
Tell us where you're playing.
I've got a show, and actually Melanie has a show with her band as well that I'm music directing for. We've got shows this summer at Festival of Arts in Laguna. Go to their website and look up Terry Wallman, look up Melanie Taylor. Mine's in July.
Mine's August 10th.
Yours is August 10th.
And I'm also co-producing a mini series called Step into the Spotlight with a couple other artists. So we're doing 3 Fridays in a row, Teron Brooks and Nita Whitaker. Anyway, so yeah, that's fun. I love producing. It's really gratifying.
Very, very cool.
And then Melanie and I have our duo.
Their weekly show.
It's our that's weekly right. show at a place Hills. In Beverly Hills yeah. called Neurano.
Yeah.
And you can go to Facebook. We'll post it, I believe, on this page
Spell
as well.
It.
It's called neranobh.com is the website, neuranobeverlyhills.com. And we've started a few weeks ago, and we've been having a great time.
Lori was there
at our inaugural opening night, and she was so great. She kind of like, I wanted to get her up and sing.
Yeah.
I have to plan it so she can sing with me.
So it's acoustic guitar on my Taylor 912C.
It's a duo thing.
And Melanie.
And so we do songs and stories. And
Melissa
very
was
cool.
there that night too.
Yeah, Melissa came and sang.
Manchester came, and Alan Rich was there, great songwriter, Alan Rich. So it's been a lot of fun. Six
and
to
it's
nine.
Upstairs, you guys. If you go and you're looking around, it's upstairs.
It's upstairs. You take the elevator up, and there's no cover charge, which is so refreshing.
No cover,
in a venue. So just come
bar
in.
Bar up there, too.
And
full bar. I want to let everybody know,
www.terrywolman.com. Right.
There's a bunch of stuff up there, some interesting stuff, and then also your music. Get your music.
Yes.
Yep.
again, it goes by really fast, but that just means you have to come back. So we definitely have to do another show.
Yeah. Yes,
we will. Bring the tower next time. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Melanie, it's great to meet
so
you.
So great to meet you. Thank you for having us. And Lori,
Lori, you're always awesome.
Yay. We appreciate you both.
Yeah.
And, okay, I'm going to take us out with the tail end of No Problem. Everybody have a great week. We will see you next week. And here's No Problem.
Thanks.